Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday, October 25th, 2022 episode of The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer, dead and gone, to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is Seth Warden of Warden and Company, an upstate New York-based folk rock group. Seth Warden, Doug Moody, and Brian Melick started out making music for kids. Now, as Warden and Company, the trio presents Somewhere, their first full-length set for people the age of those kids' parents. No matter the audience, frontman Warden says, the words mean nothing if they're not true. In our chaotic current moment, that truth is everything. Longtime veterans of the New York State music scene, Warden, Melick, and Moody originally joined forces in Saratoga Springs in 2011 as the award-winning children's and family artists Seth and the Moody Melicks. For Warden, a father of three and a middle school music teacher, making good, honest music for young ears felt organic. There's no fooling them anymore, he says of little listeners. In 2019, the trio released Songs for Everyone, their first EP as Warden and Company. The follow-up, Somewhere, presents an impressive range of instrumentation from acoustic and electric guitar, violin and viola, to organ, piano, drums, and electric bass. For a bit of creative continuity, it also features keyboardist James Mastriani, who recorded and produced Songs for Everyone. Many of the songs on Somewhere, co-produced by multi-instrumentalist Chris Carey and Warden, were written in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic. The frontman found himself teaching virtually, which at first felt very uninspired. But after a week with my kids home, I just started writing 26 songs in a summer. The producer said, "This is your appetite for destruction." Of course, Somewhere, whose strings and organic percussion evoke a relaxed late-night backyard jam with lights in the trees and possibility in the air, sounds nothing like Guns N' Roses. But for Warden, the comparison is about making a clarifying musical statement. "I felt that people who listen to this full-length debut will know who we are," he says. Somewhere is the album that defines the sound of Warden and Company and the music that group intends to share with the world. The band has been touring in support of the new album since early 2022. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Seth Warden. Hello, Seth.
Hello. Hello,
it's great, great to talk with you today and have you as a guest on my podcast.
Right back at you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You know, the first thing I was impressed with was something I read in your bio that I would like you to comment on. In your bio, there's a quote that says, you can't fake it. You sing certain messages, you better back it up off stage. Talk to us about that.
That never became so clear until I started writing music for families and children. And when you've got 150 kids in front of you and you try to fake it, they are the most aware audience that I've ever performed for. And it holds a sense of accountability to you that if you're saying be kind and you're preaching kindness and respect, then you better deliver that the second you're done and you've got 150 kids that want to slap your hand and give you a high five. Mm-hmm. Those what we sang to them on stage better be the same way we act off stage. And that was really the big eye opener on walking the walk.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really true with children, small children in particular. They smell the BS.
No kidding.
Right from the get out, you can't really pull much over their eyes. I have a 5-year-old granddaughter, and I kid her a lot, and I sometimes pull her leg and maybe stretch things a little bit, but she is on to me. There's no doubt about it.
Yep.
He just comes back with pop, you're silly, So yeah.
Absolutely.
I think that's kind of an excellent, way to look at things. When you consider that your songs are in effect an expression of who you are,
right,
and your attitudes about things. Certainly that what you sing about should be a reflection of you and your behavior. So that's probably a good idea.
Thanks. Well, that's cool.
Then that leads me to, the next thing I'd like you to talk about. You have an album that came out fairly recently, last April, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And right. would you highlight for my audience and I some of the songs from this new album and how you've kind of quote unquote kept it real in your musical message?
A lot of these songs, I would say 80% of them were written over the world remembers quarantine. And I, for the first couple of weeks, I don't think anybody was inspired and we were all uncertain on what was happening with the world. And then I realized I was home with my instruments and my children, and what a blessing that it turned into be in some point for me. So I just kept writing and writing and writing. And all of these songs, for the most part, were out of experiences and reflections on my life. Not every song is a true story, of course, but you're inspired by what you hear. I'm inspired by other musicians. I'm inspired by going to live performances and seeing other musicians. So those songs just came out of the situation, the circumstance of being a father, being a husband, a musician, a professional, all of those things that we all carry on our shoulders, lucky for me, I guess, I have an outlet, and I my therapy is music. So those are my therapy sessions. How about that?
Yeah, well, I tell you, I think, I think music is definitely great therapy. I mean, that's... it's like I had a gig last night and played and you always feel better after a gig. That's for sure.
You know it. It's funny. Like I can be dog tired as I set up my gear and I'm just like, ooh, I don't know if I've got it tonight. And then the third song in, I'm like, oh, I got it. I'm right here. I'm good. Music takes it away. It really does. It doesn't matter how many people you're playing for. Just the act of committing to creating the art and the joy, it heals you. It does.
Yeah, I could agree with you more. Well, talking about being inspired by hearing other concerts or artists, who would you say have been the primary models for your vocal style?
I think for my vocal style, that's a good question. I was really moved by the Seattle scene in the early 90s. I think I was just at that age of middle school, maybe early high school, when artists like Soundgarden and Pearl Jam came out. And I think those were the bands that made me want to commit to music. I grew up listening to wonderful music with my parents, the Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, Led Zeppelin, all of those amazing artists. But I think the 90s, that Seattle sound is what made me want to write my own music and sing maybe like them when you're so inspired as a teenager. And then artists like the Avett Brothers and then Mumford and Sons, I remember hearing for the first time and my jaw just hit the floor and how incredibly powerful the music was, yet they were all acoustic instruments. And that really inspired me to put down my electric guitar and really just try to create as much emotion through an acoustic guitar as possible and vocals. And then just recently I saw Brandi Carlile and I haven't stopped talking about it since. So just the harmonies and the amazing music that her and the twins create were so inspiring. So there you
You know,
go.
it's interesting. Of course, I've interviewed a number of singer-songwriters over the past almost 2 years. I guess I really need to get hip to Brandi Carlile because I don't know how many people have mentioned her. Lots. It just, her music and so forth. And I was also thinking too, I remember that Seattle sound, grunge, I think it was called, and kind of coming into that post-punk era of pop music. And it was, and it was kind of a stripped down but still edgy kind of sound. The edginess was more in the delivery rather than, say, the volume level of the instruments or things. Although, we did find that kind of happening as well. But yeah, it was definitely a different kind of sound that groups like you mentioned, Soundgarden and certainly Kurt Cobain and some of those others were getting. It was an interesting time period. Well,
And it's all rock and roll,
oh
any way
yeah.
you look at it, it's rock and roll. It's just in a minor key, in a little, like you said, the edgy delivery. The delivery of it. They're playing the same chords that the Beatles played. They're playing the same chords that the hair bands played right before,
Oh
and
yeah.
it's really interesting when you just look at it. There, it's all music. It's just the delivery, the vocal style, maybe the lyrics. And the type of effects used on the guitars, man. And it just changes the genre like that, and rhythm, of course.
Well, I used to when I used to teach some of the music courses I taught at the university, most of my students were non-majors. They weren't necessarily musically literate, didn't read music or maybe hadn't played an instrument. And so when I would talk about musical style or what is musical style, I would use this example. I'd tell them all look down at the floor and to look at their shoes and look at the shoes of everyone around them. And I would say, now, everybody in this room is wearing some form of footwear, but in style, they're very different. Some people are wearing boots, some people are wearing sandals, some people are wearing, athletic shoes,
Perfect.
and on and on and on, right? And I said, well, music, that's what we talk about in music as far as style, is it's the raw materials may not vary, but it's the way that they're presented, the way that they're massaged, if you will, and put forth by the particular musicians. And then when we have a time period over which those musicians tend to predominate, then we might have what we call a style period, And I used to
Absolutely.
talk about that, like especially when I taught history of rock and roll, and I'd talk about the Beatles, and I would talk about that they would have like four distinctive periods just in the 10 years or so of the career of the band, because they started out as just a pretty boy band doing covers mostly, or music that sounded an awful lot like Chuck Berry or Little Richard or Everly Brothers.
Motown.
Yeah. And then they had that mid-60s that was inspired by Bob Dylan, and they kind of went some different directions, very different directions with the music, then the psychedelic phase, and then the last phase that they returned to roots, basically, where they focused on songs that were very much influenced by roots music. So it's always interesting, I think, to look at those, you know, that idea of style and make comparisons of how different artists, they say, use the same chords, but, you know, how they approach it differently.
How they curate it.
If those individuals you've talked about have been models for your vocal style, who would you say are other singer songwriters you admire and perhaps have modeled yourself after as a singer songwriter?
As far as a lot of singer songwriters are concerned, I remember, you know, being influenced by Joni Mitchell as a young child, just because my mother would play her music. And when I found out it was just her and an acoustic guitar, I was just so blown away by her skill set to play in these open tunings. And that led into Paul Simon, of course, Harry Chapin, Jim Croce, and, you know, those, and of course, James Taylor. So, those were the singer-songwriters that influenced me in the way I think on my genetic code of songwriting. It's their songwriting. Okay, first chorus, maybe a bridge, maybe not a bridge. They're the ones that just, for some reason, my DNA locks up with that when I write songs, you know, rather than jazz or a bluegrass song. It's there. Whether I think it should rock a little more, it's still a folk song underneath.
You name off some people who I used to really, I don't used to love, I still love their music. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think like Jim Croce, you know, you think about a tune like Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. I mean, that's seriously, it's a rocker, you know, it's, and yet he could also do a sensitive ballad like Time in a Bottle.
I know.
And Harry Chapin, oh my gosh, what a storyteller. I think that's what I loved the most about Harry Chapin was the stories in his songs.
Conviction. I believed him. I believed what he's saying.
Well, you know? I think that he was really, you know, it's like you think about Taxi.
Right.
And then how he even wrote a sequel to Taxi because it was such a good story, he had to find a way to finish the story, you know.
I
never will forget one time when Harry Chapin was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And Johnny asked him, Harry, your songs are great. How come you're not more popular than you are? And he says, because it takes me longer than 2.5 minutes to say what I want to say. And most pop records, as you know, are usually 2.5, 3 minutes, right?
Quick, top 40, right? Yeah.
But I've always been a lover of Cats in the Cradle. What a beautiful song about a relationship.
One of the best ever.
Yeah. I mean, and those are some great people. I've never been to upstate New York. And so for myself and for my listeners who might be unfamiliar, talk a bit about the music scene in upstate.
I'm Saratoga County is where I am. I'm about a half an hour north of the capital of New York State, which is Albany. I went to college in Albany, got my music degree there, and spent a lot of time in Albany. It's a great small city, and it fluctuates in its music scene because there's so many state employees that work there that during the day it's packed, and then 3 o'clock Albany is a ghost town. So it was always a little bit challenging, I found, to really create a scene in Albany. So moving north about 40 minutes to Saratoga Springs, We are sitting on what could be another Seattle scene. There's enough talent here and varied talent that it is just mind-blowing on the amazing musicians that are in our area. And it really helps to keep us, I think, all on our toes a little bit. There's plenty of work. We have Saratoga, the racetrack, which keeps the bubble going as far as the economy. So there's live music in every venue on every corner. That being said, that can obviously completely saturate your market if you're playing every Thursday, Friday, Saturday on the same street corner, unless you're a cover band and you're just providing great entertainment for people, which I love doing as much as I love singing original music, I'll be honest with you, because most people can connect with a cover quicker than they're going to connect with one of your originals because they just don't know it, you know. But upstate New York, if you make the trip, obviously the summertime's wonderful. We've got great foliage in the fall, and then that snow starts to fall, and it gets pretty chilly here. But there is a great music scene. We get people from the Hudson Valley, from New York City, that take the drive up here, and vice versa. But the performances in our area, musicians get paid for their work. It's not like going to New York and you lose $150.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I hate to say it, and I know that you're performing for an opportunity. There could be someone, you know, there's too many what ifs, and there's plenty of places in the Capital District of New York State where you'll find a listening crowd. We've got Cafe Lena, the oldest coffee house in the country, and where people love to hear live music, and we're blessed, and I'm very, very blessed. I wouldn't say it's a Nashville type of scene by any means, but we support and understand the value of live music.
Well, that's encouraging to hear, you know, that you've got this wonderful pocket of activity. Is there much in the way of recording that goes on actually on scene there?
There used to be. I think obviously in the 90s and early 2000s, when recording studios were still not a dime a dozen, but they were around. I think most people have the means to do it themselves these days. We have a couple, studios locally, one in Albany, Overit Studios, and where we tracked our latest album, which is Millstone Studios, with producer and engineer Chris Carey. The work that he's been putting out has been just insane. And there's a handful, but not nearly as many as there used to be.
Okay. All right.
You know.
All right. So we've got plenty of live music and some recording going on. That's encouraging to know. I kind of want to switch gears to a more of a philosophical question. You know, we know that the ancient Greeks and Romans used to say that the purpose of tragedy in their drama was to serve as an emotional cleansing or catharsis for those witnessing the drama. So my question for you is, Seth, is are the songs you write done with the idea of providing an emotional catharsis for yourself as a reflection of personal experiences, or are many of your songs constructed to elicit a catharsis for others?
Both. Great question. I'm glad you didn't ask me to name any Greek philosophers by name, so you took care of them. Thank you. But it does bring up a very interesting question and theory of why people write music. Is it to heal yourself? Is it to help others heal? I think it's both. I think it all depends. My songwriting style is I pick up my guitar and I just try to, I put my hands somewhere completely different every time. So I start in a different spot on the neck, and I find something that sounds interesting to me, and I try to run with it. Once I've got a melody, I need to know how it makes me feel. If the melody makes me think of my heart swelling, then I'm going to focus on writing a song that means something to me. If I if I feel that, wow, this would be great to play for thousands of people at a concert, I can hear them cheering along, then I'm definitely going to focus on that. I guess that's the beauty of songwriting. I let it control me.
Okay.
I guess, because whenever I set out to do something specific, ooh, I have to write a song about this topic, then I find it to be cringy or cheesy to me, and then it comes across like country music lyrics sometimes. It's a little too to the point, you know, mm-hmm. and a little too mm-hmm. blunt. I like a little more mystery sometimes, and I'm just teasing country music fans, don't worry. I love plenty of country. But it kind of controls me more than I control. So unfortunately I don't answer your question straightforward, but
well, everybody's different, Seth, and I think that one thing I do hear, you know, I always like to ask these questions because I am genuinely interested in the creative process. And there are a lot of songwriters that I talk to that will relay a very similar kind of thing that what you've talked about, that, you know, you start experimenting and then all of a sudden something clicks and then there's like a stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, it all kind of comes together. And there are others that I'm aware of that will, you know, they're always revisiting, editing, working through all that sort of, and you probably do that anyway before you're all said and done. But, you know, it's sort of like that idea of like you said, okay, I'm going to now write a song. And of course, yes. when you come out with that sort of approach, it is going to sound stilted and trite and, you know, like I'm trying too hard, you know.
That's right. That needs to be my mentality if I'm writing a jingle. You know, okay, here's my topic. This is what I'm writing about. And I've done that a number of times for different businesses and things like that. And I love that because I don't have to worry about inspiring you and telling the story of your life. I'm just doing this. And it's a mm-hmm. pigeonhole, and that's what it is. When it comes to, obviously, my own songs and songwriting, I've got to be open to how the wave pushes me as much as I ride the wave.
Sure, sure. You know? Well, I mean, and that's really a great feeling, you know, when you kind of lose yourself in your work. It often reminds me of a book I read, I don't know how many years ago, 20, 25 years ago, called The Inner Game of Tennis, where the author of the book talked about, you know, we have two consciousnesses. We have our subconscious and then whatever we call the other one, not so sub, and that really where all our great creative juices are in that subconscious. And he talked about how what we have to do is find ways to distract the conscious mind to allow the subconscious to rise to the surface. And so he talks about various kinds of techniques and so forth. But it's also interesting, I find, that a lot of composers, singer-songwriters that I talk to will say where they get their inspiration is when they're driving in the car.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, your conscious... makes sense because your conscious mind is focused on making sure the car doesn't go off the road and you're going the right direction. And so in your subconscious mind is where all the goodies then kind of float to the surface.
It happens to me sometimes when I listen to music as well. I can get just lost and I hear one lyric and one word or two words can just take me down my own little path. I'm like, oh, that inspired me to think about this. And then I've got to take my phone out and start writing in my notes some mm-hmm. lyric ideas, you know, because that's what I do. And sometimes those lyric notes sit there for a year. Sometimes they write themselves in 5 minutes, you know. So that is what it is. I have those songs that I'm revisiting that I never released or I never put out. I didn't finish a second verse or you know, I'm not certain on what I'm saying, but I love the music so much. Those are the ones that kill me because I love the music, but I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I mean, you know, there's always lots of people that have got works in progress, and sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, coming back to something. I think after being away from it for a while, you have kind of a fresh, renewed perspective. But there's something that you said that I want to kind of drill down a little bit deeper with. You mentioned that when you sit down to write, you usually always start with a guitar, so and till you find a melody that sounds good. Would you say that that's really your what comes first to you is the melodic content, and then you work out lyrics and harmonies afterwards?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, every time I've tried to fit lyrics and write a melody around written lyrics, I have a very difficult time with that. The melody always comes first to me, and however that melody makes me feel is where I start focusing on the lyrics and if this should be a personal adventure or is this just a really feel-good song that I want everyone to be able to relate to, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, there's a number of singer-songwriters I talk to that always start with the lyrics. Most of them are former English lit or creative writing majors, you know, which I guess you can understand. The written word is really kind of their focus, and then they put music to the words. And I've had one, singer-songwriter I interviewed recently that her approach was the first thing she'd do is write a title. And then make everything in the song about that title. I said, oh, so it's sort of like writing a theme, you know, or a story, you know, you get the title and then you got to create that. So it's always interesting to me how everyone has a different approach to things.
I can find rhythm in the written word. I can find plenty of rhythms, but finding a melody within that, I got to fit the words. I have to fit the syllables to the melody. Yeah.
Sure. All right. Well, Anetta, you've already told us about you do keep a sketchbook when you get some ideas and you revisit those things as you go along. That's good to know. That's not an uncommon practice among singer-songwriters I've talked to.
I would forget them if I didn't.
Yeah.
I would. Well, I
find it very interesting. You know, of course, most people nowadays use the voice memo on the phone.
Exactly.
There's one guy I interviewed, probably 6-7 months ago, maybe even longer. Very old school, still used notebooks. In fact, during the course of our interview, he said, just a minute. And he backed out of the way so he could pan. And he had shelves of these notebooks that always had his song ideas. So some people are, everybody, different strokes for different folks.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Reflect a bit and tell us about what have been some of your more memorable experiences, your most memorable musical experiences in your career.
Oh, in my career, there's been plenty. And I call them feathers in the cap because, you know, they didn't change my life the way that you would hope they would, or they didn't provide monetary relief. But these experiences definitely changed my career. When I started professionally performing music in college, my band won a XM Radio Sirius competition to open for Bon Jovi at our local arena. And every city they went to, they had a local band compete to open for them, which, man, I'll tell you, is one of the most admirable and wonderful things that you can do for an unsigned independent group that's busting their butt to make things happen. And it was a sold out show. We got to sound check twice. We got to eat the catering. It was my first experience of what it was like at a real professional concert. And it was amazing, but yet a true Cinderella story because 11 o'clock struck and it was time to go home and go back to bed and get up and go work construction or whatever I was doing at the time. And even though I just played to 15,000 people the night before, here I was. And that was, again, one of those moments that at the time I was like, I quit. I can't do this. I can't handle this. This is crazy. Because all I wanted to do was get in the bus and follow them to the next city. No, I had to go home. And it was, wow, what a humbling experience that was for me. It was like a mini taste of this is what it's like. Keep working. And I guess if you're born an artist, blessing or a curse, it is what you've committed your life to. And, you know, there's moments where you've played for half of those people before you haven't played again for that many people. That was one of those moments that it was like you either give up now, can't get any higher, because it's only uphill now from here if you want to continue this. And, you know, of course, that band didn't work out in the end. And, you know, it was on to different music. And then children's music came and opened the door for opportunities that I never could have imagined. We performed on the Food Network twice. We toured with Paula Deen, the chef. We were her onstage band because we wrote a song called Pickle Pie. This funny kids rockabilly song called Pickle Pie opened the door for opportunities that I couldn't even begin to be enough grateful for. And all because, you know, we started having, my wife and I had children, and I was not happy with the music that they were being forced to listen to on television. And I was like, I should write some kids music. And one thing led to another, and we won an award for it. So there's just been these very serendipitous things that have happened in my music career. And performing with these gentlemen behind me, and you can see their pictures, Doug and Brian. They're two of the best musicians that I've ever been able to share a stage with, and inspire me constantly. So here we are as Warden and Company, and the next album is basically written already. So,
Well, that leads great. That leads great into my next question, but you go ahead and finish your story.
Oh, here we are. This is, and now here we are. We used Kickstarter to raise money for this album so we could professionally record it, and release it, with help from a management company and help from a PR agent. There's a first. Never hired a PR agent, as you know, Sky Media with Krista Mettler, who arranges these wonderful meetings and these interviews. That how I ever released music without her, I don't know, to be honest with you, and expected people to talk about it or listen to it.
Sure.
It is just one of those things that you live and learn. And so here we are. We've learned an awful lot. I'm very proud of this album, and I look forward to the next one.
Well, you know, it's great. I'll have to mail you a fiver, because you've just set up the next three questions very well. Because I was going to ask you if you were currently or constantly writing new material, and I'm sure you are if you've got a new album all written. And then I was going to ask you about, now that Somewhere has been released and out for about 4 months now, tell us about, as much as you can, about the new album or EP or whatever you're going to release that you've got the songs written for. Have you not recorded it yet? You've just got the songs done?
Correct. So
okay.
The songs are written and compiled on some sort of spreadsheet or notepad, if you will, so I can look them and run them through in my brain. And it's interesting that you say EP. I'm not so sure we would just spit out a whole nother album right away. Mm-hmm. Even though there's plenty of music, you know, you've got to be strategic, even though you just want to be an artist and release your music for the world. I really would like to include my daughter again, who sings on track 3 of this album, the title track Somewhere. And she added such a beautiful touch to that song, and we've gotten a lot of feedback about her addition to the music. So I'm going to try to work on some music with her as her own independent music, but as also include her again on whatever EP. So I've got a song that I've been working on with her, a couple new ideas that I just kicked myself. I'm like, why didn't I write these 4 months ago when we were recording? Oh. But whatever, it wasn't meant to be, and here they are for the next round. So,
well, Seth, would it be fair to say that the new material that you're looking to record, is it going to be a departure from stylistically or topically from the music that was on Somewhere?
I think it'll be a little more singer songwriter focused.
Okay.
Maybe a little more folk, a little less rock, but
okay.
But they still live together. It's impossible to separate from me. There'll be a couple, but I think a little more of the folk aspect of it. I love to include obviously both genres because they really are who I am musically, but some of these most recent songs have been real straight to the heart kind of ideas. So
Okay.
Guess that's where we're at.
So it might differ just from that standpoint, but what we'll still expect to hear is this, the same sort of quality Warden and Company sound that you guys get, and that's good, because I really like your music on that I've been listening to, and looking forward to that when you get that new recording out. Well,
thank you.
If I were to be able to magically hop on a jet plane and come to upstate New York where you live, where are some typical venues where I might hear Warden and Company live? Like this weekend?
Sure. Unfortunately, we're not performing this weekend.
Okay, I won't fly up this weekend then.
I'm actually in South Carolina right now, so I'll be headed back up north in a couple days. But there's some really great stages in our area. There's a stage called the Parting Glass, which predominantly more Irish rock music, but they've really been opening their doors to everyone recently, which is nice. The Putnam Den, Cafe Lena, we've been able to perform at the Troy Music Hall recently, which is a dream come true, and some great smaller venues as well, which are nice. Some wineries that we have that really pack in a great crowd of people, that just adult but listening crowd, you know, which is really nice. Lark Hall in Albany is a place that we're knocking on their door a little bit. So yeah, in our town, there's quite a few. I'm really hopeful in the next year to actually step out of our town a little bit more and start regionally touring. And getting this music, you know, to people's ears in a live format rather than just the Spotify or Apple Music format, which we're very grateful for. The streams have more than doubled since we released this album, which is wonderful. We can see that people are listening, and we can see where they're listening. We just need that jet to get us to Australia so we can go play for those people.
Well, that's good. And you did mention, so you are hoping to tour sometime in the near future, even, what's your thinking in terms of your planning? When you say regional, are you thinking limited it to New England?
East Coast.
For now.
Yeah. It's always a risk. It is a risk, and it's a risk that has a couple different weights to it. Financial, obviously, being professionals, leaving your family and your children. So, you know, it's a risk, but if you believe in it, it's got to happen. And you have to take these kind of risks. And if the music speaks for itself, it will.
Mm-hmm.
It will.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So,
well, yeah, you don't want to spread your wings too far too soon, you know. And, I had a young lady I interviewed about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. She calls herself a pop country artist, and she's in Nashville. So, yeah. And we talked about recordings, and she was mentioning that she was still just going to release singles until her fan base grows. And I thought, well, now that's smart, you know, because on sometimes with albums, you know, until someone's familiar with a group, they may not want to listen to an entire album. They may not want to do the more deep listening or the deep tracks kind of thing. But I think touring can kind of be the same way. You know, I mean, at this point in your career, a big national or international tour might be something that wouldn't really benefit you, you know?
Right. It excites us. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, patience has always been the name of the game.
Sure.
It's the one thing that we fight constantly is our patience and our desires. And every time I've let go and I've just done things like writing music for children, I didn't do that to get on the radio. I didn't do that to, you know, there was no pretense. It was just for my kids. It was a beautiful thing. I did it with my open heart. So whenever I let go of the business and I let go and I just let the art really just, this is what I'm going to do. I'm committed to it. It finds a way. Nature finds a way. I feel music also finds a way, and if it's meant to, it will. And yeah, stay grounded with it. I've accepted who I am as a musician and an artist, and I've just, if you stay true to it, there will be reward. It may not be the reward that you dreamt of, but there will be reward, you know. And I, again, that's walking the walk and trying to make sure that, you know, when I talk to kids about this, it's the same thing. You just got to find your passion. If it makes you happy, that's called success. If you get to do what you love to do, that is success. Period. So I'm staying true to it, Professor. I'm staying true.
Well, you know, that's true. If you do what you love, you never work a day in your life.
Right.
Because you're doing what you love to do. Well, Seth, I would tell you, if you ever consider coming to the Midwest, we do have some really, I think, excellent venues here in the Milwaukee area. I'm just outside of Milwaukee where I live. Okay. But in Milwaukee, there's some nice rooms to play. You know, there's a place called Shank Hall. There's a Turner Ballroom. Another place is called the Rave, which is or the larger space in the same buildings, the Eagles Ballroom. But our big claim to fame in Milwaukee is what we call Summerfest. It's the largest outdoor music festival in the world.
Wow, that sounds awesome.
And they've changed the format somewhat. COVID kind of played into that. Where this year they did it over three or 4 day weekends. I think it was 3 4-day weekends. Whereas in the past it would go for like 2.5 weeks solid.
Wow.
You know, end of June into the, you know, over the 4th of July and into July, but they'll book big name national acts. Then they have a bunch of side stages. And it's, you know, it's a kind of a thing that draws, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, if not a million people from around the area. But the Midwest is a musically ripe area. And between, you know, you've got Milwaukee, of course, we're only about 90 minutes out of Chicago, and Madison, Wisconsin, which is about an hour to the west of me, another place that would have tremendous kind of venues that would be, I think, very welcoming to your style of music.
Okay.
And then you're not that far from the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul's about 6 hours away. But so, you know, if you ever consider coming to the Midwest, there's some excellent opportunities, I think. I think, you've got to grow at your own pace and using your best judgment. And it sounds to me like you've got a good plan in mind and a good approach to doing things. I mean, you're balancing very well your professional aspirations as long along with your family and home life,
Yeah.
which is
Art.
absolutely, it's hard, but it's absolutely important. When I used to advise students, that would come to at the university, and the number one question I'd say, what kind of life do you want to live? Do you want to have the kind of life where you're home every night, where you're, do you want to travel? Do you want to be gone? Blah, 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 blah. But which then you give up, and I've had students that have gone lots of different ways. But I always get them to think about that, because when you make a commitment to being a full-time touring professional musician, yeah, it's glitzy, it's glamorous, and so forth, but you're also away from home. You're away from routine, those kinds of things that maybe you would prefer.
Right.
Everybody's different, but it is important to think about. And I would always say, I would tell my students, I said, I like to think, because I'm biased, that I found what I thought was the perfect balance for me, and that was university teaching, because at the university I could do anything I wanted to do musically, plus have some freedom to do performing off campus, and yet still have that steadiness of the salary and the health plan and all that other kind of stuff that went along with it.
The life things that we need. Yes.
Yeah. And
And
so,
that's
I mean, you have to go after what makes you happy. That's the most important thing. Because the glitz and the glamour only lasts just so long. Like you said, the next day
Yeah,
you had to
90
get up and go
minutes.
to
You have
work.
90
Yeah.
minutes a day. It
Yeah.
looks great
Yeah.
for 90 minutes, and then it's like hustle back. Where can I shower? Where are we sleeping tonight? How much money did we make or did we lose? Yeah,
Yeah.
it's not. You know, it is, it's the industry that's
Yeah.
behind the curtain.
Yeah, behind the curtain. But I always like to tell, I like to tell people that my personal philosophy is that playing music is the most fun you can have with your clothes on.
Yep.
And
Hands
like
down.
you, it's like, you go out and play, and it doesn't matter whether there's 10 or whether there's 50 people in your audience or, 250. Really what's fun is that playing the music and the interaction you have with the other musicians you're playing with. And so I think
That's why we
that's
do it.
sounds like we've got a we're very simpatico in our thinking there.
Cut from the same cloth.
There you go. Well, Seth, we've talked about a number of things, but I always like to make sure that I haven't forgotten anything that you would like to talk about. So is there anything else you'd like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
Probably just the digitals. Wardenandcompany.com is our website. Of course, we are on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Really trying to push YouTube at the moment. As an independent artist, you can make money off YouTube, so it's really an important thing for I think for artists to focus on. The digitals that do pay out something.
Sure.
Even if they're an eighth of a penny, they add up, a dime at a time, and it's music or money for your art. And I definitely encourage that. So yeah, I think all of the information about us is on our website. Our music is on there, and thanks for listening. Thanks for having me.
Well,
Appreciate it.
yeah, and I would tell you, Seth, and remind my listeners, in my show notes, which I post on my Facebook page, I include your website and also your Facebook page, and also, at least one, if not two, of your YouTube performances, so
Oh,
people
cool.
can get an idea of not only what you sound like, but what you look like.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. And I would encourage listeners, please make sure and to check out Seth Warden and Warden and Company. Wonderful group, great music. And Seth, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today. And I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you so much. I hope to see you out in the Midwest here soon.
Well, very good. You have a great rest of the day.
Take care. Thanks so much.
My discovery composer of the week is Shulamit Ron. Ron, a native of Israel, is the Andrew McLeish Distinguished Service Professor Emerita at the University of Chicago. She began setting Hebrew poetry to music at the age of 7. By 9, she was studying composition and piano with some of Israel's most noted musicians, including composers Alexander Boscovich and Paul Ben-Haim. And within a few years, she was having her works performed by professional musicians and orchestras. As the recipient of scholarships from both the Mann School of Music in New York and the America-Israel Cultural Foundation, Ron continued her composition studies in the United States with Norman Delajoyo. In 1973, she joined the music faculty of the University of Chicago. She lists her late colleague and friend, Ralph Shapey, with whom she also studied in 1977, as an important mentor. In addition to receiving the Pulitzer Prize in 1991, Ron has been awarded most major honors given to composers in the United States, including 2 fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, grants and commissions from the Koussevitzky Foundation at the Library of Congress, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Frohm Music Foundation, Chamber Music America, the American Academy and Institute for Arts and Letters, first prize in the Kennedy Center Friedheim Awards competition for orchestral music, and many more. Her music has been played by leading performing organizations, including the Chicago Symphony under both Daniel Barenboim and Pierre Boulez, the Cleveland Orchestra under Christoph von Dohnányi in 2 United States tours, the Philadelphia Orchestra under Gary Bertini, the Israel Philharmonic under Zubin Mehta and Gustavo Dudamel, the New York Philharmonic, the American Composers Orchestra, the Orchestra of St. Luke's under Yehudi Menuhin, the Baltimore Symphony, the National Symphony in Washington, D.C., Contempo, the Contemporary Chamber Players at the University of Chicago under both Ralph Shapey and Cliff Colnott, the Orchestra de la Suisse Romande, the Jerusalem Orchestra, the vocal ensemble Chanticleer, and various others. Ron's chamber and solo works are regularly performed by leading ensembles in the United States and elsewhere, and recent vocal and choral ensemble works have been receiving performances internationally. Between 1990 and 1997, she was composer in residence with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, having been appointed for that position by maestro Daniel Barenboim as part of the Meet the Composer Orchestra Residencies program. Between 1994 and 1997, she was also the 5th Brenna and Lee Freeman Sr. Composer in Residence with the Lyric Opera of Chicago, where her residency culminated in the performance of her first opera, Between Two Worlds, the Dybbuk. She was the Paul Frohm Composer in Residence at the American Academy in Rome, September through December 2011. Ron served as music director of Tempus Fugit, the International Biennial for Contemporary Music in Israel, in 1996, 1998, and 2000. Since 2002, she is Artistic Director of Contempo, Contemporary Chamber Players of the University of Chicago. In 2010, she was the Howard Hansen Visiting Professor of Composition at the Eastman School of Music. Shulamit Ron is an elected member of the Academy of Arts and Letters, where she was Vice President for Music for a three-year term, and of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. The recipient of 5 honorary doctorates, her works are published by Theodore Presser Company and by the Israeli Music Institute and recorded on more than a dozen different labels. The All Music Guide lists 13 recordings of Ron's chamber music, 1 recording of her Credo Ani Maim for choir, 5 recordings of her concerti, 4 recordings of her work for keyboard, 2 of her orchestral works, 3 of her works for voice, and 3 works classified by the All Music Guide as miscellaneous works. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video of a performance of Shulamit Ron's Yearning for Violin and Strings with Cello Obbligato, performed by the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Well, that's a wrap on episode number 108. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Coming up next week, I'll be interviewing New York City-based jazz drummer Donald Edwards. We have a great discussion about his performing and recording career and the New York jazz scene. Other upcoming interviews include big band leader, composer, arranger, and Berklee College of Music faculty member Stephen Feifke, New York City-based multi-woodwind artist, composer, arranger, and band leader Ben Kono, Chicago-based blues singer, songwriter, and guitarist Nick Moss, and New York City-based jazz drummer Zach Edelman. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.